This is The Conversation. It's episode 196 with Matthew Gardocki. He was gallery manager with Patrick Painter, pretty well known here in Los Angeles, and more recently was with Mark Moore, which closed its doors towards the end of last year. We talk all about all of those things, along with Deb Cloudenman, returning champion and gallerist here in Los Angeles as well. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is still theconversationpod.com. Check out back episodes. Check out images. Some of the last few episodes have been really good ones with Gene Shin, Grayson Earle, Tim Schneider. You can also donate to the show via Patreon and or PayPal at the website as well. So yeah, it was a relatively free-ranging conversation between the three of us covering the art world, not only in LA, but generally, particularly vis-a-vis mid-tier galleries versus larger galleries versus emerging galleries. And we also drift into parity in terms of treatment for men and women in the workplace when it comes to having kids, which is something that relates to Matthew specifically, and he shares a very unusual pregnancy story as well. So you have all that to look forward to. Before we get there, I wanted to make sure you are up to speed on a particularly entertaining, for lack of a better word, anecdote that by the time you listen to this, happened almost a month ago. I believe it was the beginning of July that it actually happened. It was reported in the middle of July, but it was a selfie mishap. Did you hear about this? Here in Los Angeles, I have not still been to 14th Factory, which apparently is known as a pop-up gallery and also a nonprofit downtown. And so long story short, a selfie turned into a cascade of pedestals falling. If you haven't seen the video yet, do yourself a favor and go take a quick look. Just search selfie mishap 14th Factory and you should find it quickly. And now that you've seen it, what I find, among other things interesting, is as I was watching it, I was actually looking at the wrong person taking a selfie until I saw, oh no, it's that person in the corner who was responsible for the... So this girl was doing a selfie. She backed up into one of the pedestals in one of these four rows of pedestals, and she backed up against one. It hit the next and cascaded like dominoes, leading to quote-unquote $200,000 worth of damage. That seemed to be the most popular keyword in the title of the various news coverage of it, whether it was USA Today or LA Times or New York Times or LAist or Mashable. The $200,000 figure seems to really be a popular one. And the reason I bring this up is not only to alert you to the fact that it happened, and it's quite amusing, but also somebody that I know who will remain anonymous, who works at the Broad here in Los Angeles, the Broad Contemporary, which is, what, a year and a half old now, is it already? Maybe more. He has told me about the over-the-top selfie culture that permeates the Broad's galleries these days, which has led to mishaps there as well, less publicized ones. He told me about one that cannot be repeated until he is no longer an employee there, and I can't tell you about it either, but let's just say it was a mishap. And otherwise, you know, you've got people doing the Coons flowers selfie, you know, et cetera, without going through the list of all the things. But that's what you see, of course, in the Yayoi Kusama mirrored infinity room. Is a big one as well. Apparently there was damage to that one. And was it in DC in the process of a selfie there? So all that to say that selfies and art, is with us in full force these days. And I'm not immune to it and I'm sure you're not either, because when I go to galleries now, there is definitely a factor that's like, oh, that would be good for Instagram, right? Am I wrong? Are you with me? So we're all in this together. The question is, can we tone it down a bit? I suspect not, and I imagine that you suspect not as well, but you know, just a question. Just a little food for thought that I wanted to put out there. All right, so on the back end, I'm going to tell you about, speaking of mishaps, I'm going to tell you about adventures in day job, or more like adventures in secondary gig in my life. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, enjoy this conversation. I'll talk to you more on the back end. It's been what, a little over, how long has it been since Mark Moore closed?
So Mark announced he was going to close in the beginning of September 2016, and then we stayed open with the exhibition we had at the time that was opening in September, because we had, you know, guaranteed the artist. That exhibition ran the first week of September through right before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And then close it down, and that was it. So that weekend of Thanksgiving, they were done.
Yeah. And you had been there 4 or 5 years?
I was with Mark for six.
6 years, sorry.
Yeah, 6 years.
Got it.
So okay. I was with Mark. I started with Mark at Bergamot Station. I think I was there for two shows at Bergamot, and we moved right into the new space.
And what was it like, both psychically and market wise, moving from Bergamot Station to Culver City?
Foot traffic was different. Foot traffic was slower, but the quality was better in Culver City than it was at Bergamot.
Okay, so when you say quality, a couple of things come to mind. There's quality of percentage of sales made, and then there's quality of general intelligence of the visitor.
I would go with both of those.
Okay. No offense, Bergamot.
Yeah, no. And, you know, it wasn't like, you know, teetotalers or like kids coming in on a school bus, you know, running rampant through the gallery. It was, you know,
right.
We had collectors that are established in LA and European collectors that would, you know, they come to Culver City. There were people that I saw the first few months we were there that I had not seen in Bergamot in 3 years. You know, they never stepped foot at Bergamot. And then we moved to Culver City. I'm like, oh, where have these people been? Because they're not going to Bergamot.
Well, this actually brings up an interesting through line, because we could have gotten to later, which is that you were at Patrick Painter.
Yes.
In the past, which has been a long-standing Bergamot Station gallery, right?
Yeah.
So here's the first question. At what point, having experienced a couple of different versions of Bergamot, at what point do you feel like it started to go downhill, for lack of a better expression?
I don't know. I think that the quality was always good. I think once people started to establish themselves in Culver City, then less people were coming further west to go see shows. You know, unless you were in, you know, on that side of town, but you weren't getting the same collectors. And I think from there, it just kind of, you know, it started to go downhill from there. I think one of the things that may have been was that about 3 years into working for Patrick, so that's probably like 2009, they started putting in a water treatment. Like, you know, they were testing the groundwater. I'm like, oh, that's weird. What are they planning on doing? And then they announced that they were going to turn Bergamot into the, you know, the stop. And then it's like everybody started, you know, Mark found a building that he moved into. Then there was a building on the other side of Bergamot that was for sale. And then that sold, and that's, you know, turned into an open air that's like office building. And then I just think the quality of work that was being shown wasn't, you know, what you could find elsewhere in town.
Yeah.
It's interesting how quickly that shift can happen. And I feel like critics still go to Bergamot, maybe not as often as downtown or Culver City, but they're still, but I feel like the shift with collectors happens pretty intensely.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the concentration of galleries that are in Culver City, the quality was much better than the group of galleries that are at Bergamot. If you're going to Bergamot, you're going to, like, see two shows and then you're out of there. It's like there may be 25 galleries, but really two of them are doing show, you know, exhibitions that are worth going to see.
Right.
You know?
Well, and there are a lot of people there who've been there for a long time and do a lot of secondary market work and sales, and that's a whole different animal. Not to say, I know that Mark does and did a lot of that as well, but you know, the contemporary programming was clearly the forefront of
the and I think Mark just wanted to own the building he was in.
Yeah.
I think he was looking towards the future with Catlin taking over the gallery at some point.
And you want to clarify for listeners
who Catlin Moore. So Catlin Moore is Mark's daughter, who is also the director at the gallery. So I think he was looking to the future, like, if I'm going to move, I'm going to own the building that we're in. And then, you know, at some point in the future, Catlin can, you know, take over and take the reins of the gallery.
This is tricky as far as how much we get into your former boss, you know, versus you, you know, like I could ask you, like, so what happened with Catlin and Mark, and you know, but that's not really about you.
Yeah, that's not that's on them.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody's got it.
Yeah. Well, so you were with Patrick Painter before.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm trying to get to sort of some kind of through line thought or question. As far as, I guess, I mean, is it fair to say that they're both mid galleries and, you know, and Mark Moore was a victim of the mid gallery phenomenon, which is not being a behemoth and not the work only being so high of a level of price and what have you, and that kind of thing? How would you like to describe it?
I think that they were two different programs. I think that, you know, Mark did things his way and ran it, you know, like a family business. And he had been around longer than Patrick in the way of running a gallery. And I think that Mark was very dedicated to the artists that he showed. And I think maybe the connections between some of the higher end or blue chip galleries and Mark were, you know, you have galleries that will consign from blue chip galleries, maybe a smaller gallery that they're getting works that are, you know, high caliber. So we didn't have that situation at Mark's, but that was fine. But at Patrick's, you have a situation where you have Jim Shaw, you have Mike Kelly, you've got, you know, you're able to, like, you have connections to Simon Lee and Max Hetzler and Gagosian that, you know, we didn't consign works like that from those types of galleries at Mark's. So Patrick kind of had that where he was able to get those artists in and show them. So I think that I don't know if Patrick would have been at the time was mid-tier. I mean, everybody was hot for whatever Patrick was showing, especially Germans that he showed.
Yeah.
I think I said that because it feels like in the last, since they're still around for the last, who knows, 5 years or whatever, at least they've been showing not these superstar artists. And so that's why I guess I may try to make that connection.
Yeah. Well, with Patrick, I don't know a lot of people that he had in the program have moved on, you know, Jim's at Blum and Poe and, you know, Mike's passed on, but I think at that time Mike was already out anyways. When I was there, he was showing at Gagosian, and I don't see, you know, where his relationship was with Patrick. I know we were doing additions with him, but besides that, I don't know, in the way of having an exhibition with him, I doubt that was going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's part of, you know, what Michael was saying with the mid-tier gallery referencing pretty much anything that isn't one of the mega galleries with lots of multiple locations, like Gagosian or Pace or Hauser and Wirth and, you know, Zwirner. What happens, you know, when you have been doing solid business for a long time, but you have the possibility of losing artists to people who have the infrastructure set up to be able to just add a zero or two or three to their prices and, yeah. you know, yeah. all that kind of stuff.
And, you know, the other thing, too, is you know, I would say that with Patrick, while the program, you know, was great, you know, you're talking about different management styles, you know, of how you deal with artists, Absolutely. Employees, everybody. So that, you know, that has an effect on how long people are going to stay there for. And I think, at least for me, I worked for Patrick for 5 years. We went through 6 directors
Wow.
while I was there in 5 years. And I mean, that's, you know, directors turn over, but that was like, it was brutal.
Yeah.
But I mean, I stayed because I love Patrick and Yeah. I learned a lot from him in the way the market was and Yeah. how to sell. And
what did he teach you about how to sell?
Just, you know, just how to approach people. Especially when you're dealing with, you know, I started there as a prep. So it went from working as a prep to, you know, Patrick and I got along. Patrick trusted me and was like, hey, do you want to go to an art fair? And I was like, sure, I'll go to an art fair. What do I got to do? He's like, oh, you got to work on the shipping and install the booth and sell stuff while we're there. And I'm like, okay, so you mean I'm just going to be there
do
all
everything.
Day long
yeah.
and do everything? Sure, I'll do it. I'm young and stupid. But we had somebody, we had a sales director that was there also to help. So there were 3 of us basically in the booth. So it was more of like, you know, Patrick would introduce me to collectors and kind of, you know, if I'm not here, you can talk to Matthew or talk to Edward. These are the people that are here
right.
that you can deal with. So as people became more comfortable with me being there, you know, people would approach me. And then I just got used to doing it, at least selling work.
And did you like it?
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. I mean, I liked going to fairs. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's on somebody else's dime. So I get to travel, you yeah. know. I mean, I get to go to all these interesting countries and cities. I get to go see art that sometimes is stuff that you don't even see in a museum, especially if it's a secondary market piece that is at somebody's house and it comes out. The only place you're going to see it at is the fair.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. And it might be in somebody's house for another 20 or 30 years and you won't see it again. So it was... That part of it was enjoyable. I mean, right. the grind of doing it
yeah.
after a while, because I know with Patrick, we were doing 7 fairs a year. So every other month, we were gone for 15 days. Sometimes you do back-to-back, so you'd be gone for a full month. And after a while, that grind got to be a little much.
Yeah.
I think at the end of 5 years, I was like, okay, I
yeah.
need to, you know, take a step back and think about how, you know, do I want to be in this gallery setting or do I want to be somewhere else that maybe the program's younger artists and maybe it's a smaller gallery,
yeah,
shall we say? And, you know, it's more easygoing and not so, like, high pressure
yeah.
stress. And Mark approached me one day at Bergamot and got along. I called a bunch of people to ask about
yeah,
him, you know,
yeah.
to vet him. And then I just moved over to Mark's. And it's way... more comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, we should, before we maybe, we should go back to Patrick Painter maybe, because we, yeah. I don't think we've covered all of that. One of the things that when you were talking about getting to travel, you know, to the art fairs, of course you have to reconcile that with the description of going to an art fair, as I'm sure Deb can very well speak to, and basically being trapped inside your booth for the whole time that you're in that city. I mean, how much of it was that versus actually seeing the city?
You just have to get up early in the morning or stay out late at night.
Yeah.
It's pretty much, it's
right.
It is 24/7 for 12 days or
right.
13 days to
right.
like, you know, do stuff. And I think Patrick was good about us. You know, we would book flights so we got there a day early or we'd leave a day later. So we kind of had, you know,
right.
it's not like we came back right away. It was, you know, we had a full day after the fair to be like, oh, I can go check out the museum that's in town, or I can, you know,
yeah.
I can sleep in. But most of the time it was like, oh, I'm here. I'm going to take advantage of this and, you know, as much of it as I can.
And how much of it is your constitution was already there in the first place versus that your constitution grew as you continued to do it?
I think when I started out as a prep, I think as I got into the traveling part and the selling and then just managing, I guess, artists, is it grew more, you know? Like, then I started to, I think as I got more comfortable.
Yeah. And you're obviously an extrovert, yeah? I mean, you pretty much have to be to do that, I would think.
Not really.
No?
No.
Well, I mean, if you define, but it would just say, if you define the classic sort of technical definition of introvert, extrovert, the introvert loses energy being around people, and extrovert gains energy being around people. If you're losing energy being around people for 7 days, 24 hours a day, you're gonna kill yourself.
No, that I don't. I mean, I love being around. Yeah, people, it's great. Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
I'm saying, okay, I thought you were saying extrovert in the way, like, I'm running around with my shirt off in the middle.
No, that's that's gregarious.
Yeah. No, but yeah. I mean...
Or exhibitionist, if right, you're doing that's, it with your shirt off. Right. Next,
Yeah. That's an extreme extrovert.
Extreme extrovert.
Yeah, there we go.
I think it's finding ways to recharge. I'm always a little bit jealous when I hear people talk about doing art fairs for the first time and getting into it before they had kids, because I always schedule everything so that I have the minimum nights away possible. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have that extra couple of days ahead of time, or day ahead of time and day afterwards. And so I'm always a little bit like,
I want to go see
that museum. Yeah. Well, I mean, I do. I wake up really early in the morning and like, you know, you do. It's always crazy anyways, but
right.
Yeah,
right.
Definitely.
Got it. Okay. And then the other thing is, to whatever degree you feel comfortable talking about it, what was the different management style that you alluded to where six directors paraded through?
It was very difficult to get a hold of Patrick when things were on fire, shall we say. So you had to learn to put out some of those fires yourself. So right. I became a very good fireman.
Right. Well said.
It's
a
good skill to have.
Yeah.
And then maybe a few days down the road, Patrick called, hey, whatever happened with that?
Brilliant.
It's been dealt with. It's been handled. It'll be, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, the artwork will be here and, you know, there's no big rush. Don't worry
about it. Right.
He wasn't around that often, but when he was there, it was, you know, a lot of attention was given to Patrick and, you know, Patrick made, you know, he was there. He was, you know.
Yeah.
You definitely knew. So he, you know, he would ask a lot of you when he was there. There were times where, you know, things would get stressful, but then, you know, Patrick would be nice and like give somebody a break, or you might get some extra cash thrown your way, or, you know, but it wasn't often enough, especially for the stress that some people were under. I didn't mind because I wasn't the director. I was just the gallery manager. So I didn't have the stress that they had of like, you know, Patrick's on them all the time. And I think Patrick trusted me immensely with a lot of things at the gallery. So he wasn't concerned that, you know, the place was going to blow up if I'm there and he's not there, at least he knew that things would get handled because I became a very good fireman.
Right.
So
in terms of the role of the gallery manager versus director, for people who may not be as familiar with the way that job responsibilities separate out, would you say that that meant that you were more in charge of logistics, keeping everything smoothly running?
Yeah, I would say... the logistics, so logistics, shipping, you know, being in charge of, you know, looking over the registrar to make sure that that's getting done, talking to artists about their upcoming exhibitions, not the way that their director would, but in the way that like, okay, so what are you planning on sending? What do you have in the studio? You know, these are the dates and deadlines that I need everything by so that we can have the registrar bring everything, you know, log everything in. I can have the preps ready or the prep ready for when this stuff arrives. So I kind of learned how the art moved in and out. And then typically after a sale was made, at least through the director, same thing if I made a sale, like seeing it all the way through, making sure it got to where it was, make sure everybody's happy, send them a book. And, you know, so it was kind of, it was a good way to learn how to be the director of the gallery without like the pressure of some of those things that would be put on them.
You mentioned when we spoke on the phone, and I'd like to revisit it a little more detail. When you were, I think, at Basel, but you correct me if I'm wrong, and a couple of an artist or two maybe came up to you and were asking what happened to their payment kind of thing?
Yeah. There's times, I mean, every gallery goes through hard times. And sometimes, you know, it's not my idea of how things should work, but, you know, art would sell and money may not go to the artists right away. It might be 3 months. It might be 6 months. It might be 9 months. So you start to run into a problem with that artist getting you inventory, starting to not trust you or the gallery. So there was a situation where I had two different artists, two different days, come in to the booth and, you know, pulled me aside and said, "Where's my money?" I'm like, "I'm not in charge of the money. I don't know. I don't know what's going on." "Well, I've been calling for months. I've been writing for months. I haven't got paid." I'm like, "I didn't know that. I'm like, I don't know what the financial situation is, but I don't know why you haven't got paid. I can ask and find out." That'd be great. You can ask and find out for me. Because they trusted me to actually ask.
Right.
Right.
And they knew, he'll talk to Pat. You know, he'll ask and then he'll get a response. So I would ask and be like, "Oh, no, we'll take care of it. We'll take care of it." So it was kind of, you know, just blowing it off. Like, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it." But as those months grew longer and kind of piled on top of each other, that's when I'd be pulled aside and say, "Look, you're very nice. You're a good human being. You should not be here anymore. This is a bad situation for you. You should find a gallery that you enjoy being at." And I'm like, "No, I like it here." And they're like, "No, you don't like it here. You're just led to believe that you like it here." It's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome, maybe. So, I think in 2009, 2010. So Basel 2010, we came back and I was just like, "You know what? It's, I've got a, we came back. I had a couple days off, got into July, took a vacation. I came back from vacation. I was like, "You know what? I don't have to be here. I can find something else now," especially after being with him for 5 years. Yeah. I think I've learned enough that I can kind of move on. So that's where, you know, it came time to like think about, well, where do I want to move on to and who would I work for? And then it was like, well, I want, like I said, work for a gallery that maybe has a group of artists that are younger, probably similar in age, that is probably a little more relaxed and not so like traveling all the time and high pressure. And that's where, you know, Mark and I started to talk. I met Mark, visited with him. I knew a couple people in the program already. So I decided to take the job there.
So you got recruited, is that right?
Yeah.
So is that pretty, how frequent is that?
I don't know. I mean, Mark saw me every day in the parking lot sweating, dragging stuff from one side of Patrick's to the other gallery that Patrick had, along with the prep and running between the two. Because at the time, Patrick had two spaces at Bergamot, one by the cafe.
Patrick Painter, west and east.
Yeah, east, even though they're across each other from the parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I started with Patrick and we didn't even have that other building yet. We weren't in that building yet. So he would see me every day and he'd always say hi. I'd see him and, you know, talk to him. It was casual. And then when I met with him and I talked, you know, I talked to a few people that knew him, other people that are in art world, shippers, artists, other gallery dealers, that knew Mark, I would talk to them, gave him calls. He's like, "Here's a list of people. You can call all these people, see what they say about me." I'm like, "No, I trust you." And I met with him and he was great. It was like my dad. Yeah. It was like so great. It was such a difference between like this kind of, he doesn't, Mark doesn't demand a lot of attention where, you know,
yeah.
somebody's out there with attention. They have a lot of gold chains.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little
like
much.
Patrick.
Yeah. Mark's not like that.
Yeah.
And it's very relaxing. You know, so it made right. me feel comfortable, and then it made me feel like somebody's like, no, you can do this job and you do a good job at it. So you should work for me because you're not being appreciated over here. You should come over here.
Yeah.
So that's how that started.
And to your question, Michael, I think it is pretty common, not necessarily like across the parking lot, although it recently happened on La Cienega across the street. But I think...
Can you?
It's a relatively small world, and people who are really great at their jobs and really competent are definitely sought after. Well, yeah,
I've gone on a couple interviews. No calls back.
Yeah, I mean, but then it's also. People don't have a lot of money at the
yeah,
same
no,
time.
I
mean, well, there's that thing is everybody. You know, everybody's looking for a fantastic director, and then at the same time, everybody's like, ooh, I don't have a lot of money. So,
I wish I could ask you about that reference you made to Across La Cienega, but I'm not going to because you seem a little uncomfortable with it.
I haven't talked to either of the parties involved directly about it, and so I just don't
sure.
feel
right.
great about
that's
yeah.
Yeah. If it's not you're the one it's who's involved.
Yeah,
yeah
I'm not
totally
directly involved.
I think a really good I think a really vital word here is, or expression is family run, mm-hmm. you know, that you mentioned earlier, because that's how you describe Mark Moore's gallery. And now that the gallery is done, it's closed, that seems to be the type of gallery that is struggling the most to stay alive. And it's like you either are a corporation gallery or you're an emerging gallery. And it's like that family gallery is like really struggling.
Yeah. I think with, you know, there's probably a few exceptions, but I think that's because, you know, we can look at like Davidson Contemporary, like
sure.
the Davidsons. I mean, the family, the main gallery, we'll say, like
yeah.
that is a beast. And then, you know, Charlie and David have their contemporary gallery.
Right.
So they're going to show younger artists and. So I think that like something like that, they're fine because they have support from another area. But when it's family run, your support is you. You know,
right.
there's not like, you know, you can partner up with other dealers and other galleries to kind of get work in. But I think that, you know, sometimes people start out with the intentions of I'm going to change the world and then kind of just get stuck in this rut of this is how I do things and not understand that maybe they should go for something. Not something bigger, but kind of go after big fish.
Yeah.
And see how it goes. And I think, you know, that could be part of the struggle. I do think that, you know, artist-run spaces are interesting because some artist-run spaces end up becoming galleries.
Absolutely.
Like the Pit was an artist-run
right.
space, and then all of a sudden I was like,
sure.
oh, we have a program now.
Yeah, Night Gallery too.
Yeah. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But how long are they going to survive for?
I mean, I think it really depends. I mean, I remember... When I first opened the gallery, I spoke with this former museum director who was sort of a family friend, but I hadn't actually spent time with. And he sat me down and he was like, Deb, all I can tell you is you get, you know, 12 different art dealers from around the city all sitting around the table and you ask each one of them why they're doing it. And you're going to get a pretty different answer from each one of them. And the answer to that question is extraordinarily important in terms of how you continually revise your business model and recognize whether or not what you're doing is on the right path and whether or not it's actually for you. And I think it's hard if you start with a great deal of idealism and then you reach that point where, you know, you feel a practical limit on a model that was working for you for a good while in terms of being able to maintain the original ideals of why you started in the first place. I think that's when you start getting a lot of letters like we've been seeing from spaces all over the country where people say this isn't fun anymore, or this isn't, and the general consensus that people come up with is, oh, well, they just couldn't make it financially. And I feel like, sure, that's true, but I also feel like there's a point at which it's not, you can't make it financially, but do you want to continue to put in this effort if the original reason why you decided to start is not manifesting?
Yeah. I mean, you have to change the way you're doing business.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's just being able to change, but change on the fly.
Yeah, you know? Totally. And I think that's hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think that some people have been trying to, you know, some galleries have, while they've closed the brick and mortar, they've moved into online and trying to sell and do exhibitions that way. I mean, there's the idea of, you know, private curating at spaces, or doing shows that are pop-ups, or, you know, still managing artists, but not in the way of, you know, having a true exhibition space. Some artists may stay on board with that idea. Some artists will probably leave because, I mean, artists want an exhibition space to show in. But I do think that while galleries have to change the way they do their business and their model, I think artists also equally have to change the way that they do their business and understand that, you know, if you're with a gallery, maybe you're not going to be in an exhibition brick and mortar, but maybe they can offer you something else where they can find you another space, or they can, you know, put you in another space to exhibit in. But I think both parties need to be a part of the discussion.
Yeah, I think that's
to help each other out.
I think that's a huge point and not something that is done very often.
Because you have dealers on one side complaining they don't have enough inventory to sell, but then they close because they don't have any money.
Right.
And they have artists that are complaining because they're not getting into right collections or having shows. And this is not for every gallery. This is, you know, there's people that are not struggling that are doing fine. So keeping it fresh, I guess, and just seeing when the writing's on the wall.
Yeah.
Well, Deb, the subtext of what you were saying a minute ago sounded to me like if you're a gallerist who is survived or evolved over a certain amount of time and your original vision is no longer possible, it sounds like either I sell out, quote unquote, or I give up my integrity, or I just get out of it. Is that kind of
right? What you're... And I think what Matthew's saying is there needs to be another, and I agree with this,
right?
There needs to be another way of dealing with that problem when you get to that point, so that it's not just either I become something that I've never been interested in, or I close. It's also, what ways can we, I mean, it's such an obnoxiously overused word, but it's the one that comes to mind. What ways can we innovate this model and be flexible with how we're approaching it that will, you know, allow for a different way of moving forward?
And the other thing.
Did I just miss paraphrase?
No. I think that artist run spaces are great because artists can be artists, but then there's commercial galleries, and there's a word that it's commercial in front of it. It's not like art gallery. It's commercial gallery. So it's, I mean, there has to be income generated to stay open, or you just have to have a staff of one.
Yeah.
Right. You know, right.
And a space to do it. And then what ends up happening is maybe you do find an artist that you do very well with, and then all of a sudden you got to start worrying about who's going to poach them from you. But if you're honest and you're good to them, then, you know, hopefully they'll stay there.
Yeah. And I think a lot of artists are now needing to approach the way they do things with a real business capacity, or not business capacity necessarily, but a strategic capacity. So I think there are artists who might have the option to be with larger galleries who choose instead to work with a number of medium-sized galleries who they know they're going to be in, you know, the starting lineup for them, rather than be kind of one of 30 people who all carry equal weight and significance in a larger program. So I think, everybody's trying to think about different ways of making it all work.
It's a weird time.
Yeah, it's a weird time. I mean, it's a weird time for, but it's a weird time for so many different realms of culture and business and who we are as humans. You know, it's like everybody is trying to figure out how to exist in this hybrid form. So it makes sense to me.
Well, what do you mean by hybrid form?
I mean you look at, not to say that, I mean, the art world is, of course, its own unique animal, but if you also look at other retail or experience-oriented business models right now, you see that, you know, retail stores, let's look at fashion, who started out being exclusively opaque and all brick and mortar and limiting online ability because they were too high-end, are now trying to also have online presences. And then things like Amazon or places that were always exclusively online are now also trying to have brick and mortar. So it just feels like there's a way that everybody is trying to navigate mm-hmm. print publications, online publications. Museums certainly have gone pretty quickly from being anxious about the idea of having their visual archives accessible to everybody for free to being like, please look at our Instagram posts where we are going to show you every element of our visual archive for free 3 times a day, and we'll text you artwork. Yeah.
It's,
you know,
taken some time for that to happen, though. I mean, yeah, I think LACMA was really great about getting out there early with that kind of stuff, especially with when LACMA was very good about it, and then you'd go to the Getty and they'd be like, no photographs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're kidding, right? I mean, you realize that, like, this is helping you promote its free like,
and how's it worth, too, right?
Yeah. And I think, well, the other thing that goes to that is now you've got galleries that are museums.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's depends on what you say about the work. I mean, it's work that might have been shown before, you know, and recontextualizing and trying to make it a museum show. But they're doing museum quality shows at galleries that museums can't do, maybe because the work is challenging. And they don't have access to all that work where the gallery knows where all the bodies are buried. They can get the work, or they have it as inventory, or they manage the estate. And I think that a museum, you've got 20 people on the board, everybody's gonna have a different opinion, all the curators, it's got to go through all these people for it to happen. If you're a mega gallery, you're like, oh, we want to do a museum quality show, that's what we're gonna do, we're gonna do it next week. Right. It could happen,
right?
Yeah.
You know, they can do it right away. Museums are like dinosaurs. But now, like, with them, like, helping to promote with, you know, online and being able to take photographs, I think they're trying to, like, get with the times, you know, and get people to come into the museum spaces, because I don't think that they're getting money from local governments that is coming in that's kind of gone away. So you've got to have patrons that are coming in and paying to visit and see it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think, to me, what's particularly important about what Matthew was referring to earlier about mid galleries being commercial galleries and that struggle, I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me is, I mean, you can talk about a museum like gallery that can put together a museum show in a second. You know, you're talking about already canonized artists, right, in that sort of realm. So what we're talking about with these mid-sized galleries are galleries where the artists are at a range of well-established levels, but not in that sort of heavyweight gallery kind of category, right? So the question then becomes, you know, how much are the collectors playing a role in what the survival of that gallery is? And to me, my instinct says that if the work is not easy enough / commercial enough, you know, that's kind of where that falling point is. So if you're being like an artist run space, which has the opportunity to be experimental, if you're being too experimental, you fall off the commercial range. And, you know, if you keep pushing that kind of agenda, or if you over push that agenda, you can no longer survive as a commercial gallery.
Yeah.
I think in terms of, again, flexibility of model, like, one of the reasons why I'm always interested in people who have very interdisciplinary ways of working is, even though on the one hand that is harder to market, on the other hand, it allows for parts of somebody's work that are more experimental and at the same time having a range of work within there that you can place in the market, so that hopefully they begin to get support on both sides. So the people who are collecting the work that is, you know, maybe more object oriented or easier to access in that way, also then have motivation to help be patrons of the work that is more experimental, because that will get more critical acclaim or potential museum attention. So I think there are ways of navigating that even before you get to the blue chip level, but it does take navigating.
It's not easy navigation.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I will say that, another thing with, we'll say mid-tier, but I think a lot of galleries that had been around, we'll say 15 years or longer, mm-hmm. Nothing within the last, I'd say 10 years. I think that those galleries, the programs are younger, maybe they're still new in the way of garnering collectors and building, the mid-tier galleries that have been around longer, some of those, had access to secondary market work. So a lot of the ways to keep your doors open was that you could get a secondary market work and, somebody wants it, you'd sell it, you'd make a little bit off of it. But those amounts were so great that it keeps your door open. So you can do a show that, oh, hey, I'm going to do this show and lose 30 grand, but I did place this, Ruchet work on paper between two collectors, and that covers the cost of the show. So I can do this and not really worry about
it. Absolutely.
And I think that a lot of secondary market work, especially good secondary market work, is just dried up. It's very hard to find because those dealers are competing with auction houses that are now, they know where everything's at.
Yeah.
And they're offering, guarantees again, where they weren't, maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, they weren't offering guarantees, and then they got back into offering guarantees. And people that are buying work from auction houses are saying, look, in 5 years, I can guarantee you 10-15% return on the work that you purchased. So make sure you bring it back to us if you're interested. So, I mean, they're guaranteeing somebody. Like, how could I do that as a dealer? Like, if I sold you a painting, I'm like, hey, if you bring that painting back, it's a young artist, but in 10 years, I can guarantee you a 20% return. Like, that is crazy. But those secondary market works are what helps keep the doors open.
Absolutely.
For mid galleries to do programming that they were doing. And now that it's dried up, it's harder to stay open because it's harder to find good material. I mean, there's definitely a difference between a good Ruchet and a bad Ruchet, and it's like, the demand might not be there.
Yeah.
So it's the money gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and the inventory gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and you can't keep open.
Mm-hmm. And I think I would say that that's been a way of keeping the doors open for a lot of dealers in, LA, New York, and certainly plenty of other places where it's also not something they talk about, especially in New York amongst contemporary galleries. For a long time, there was a bit of a negativity associated with being seen as somebody who sold secondary market work. I mean, it was a little bit like, oh, well, you sold out, we're not going to take your primary programming seriously anymore. And of course, a lot of the dealers who have been really looked up to as fantastic contemporary dealers did that. They just did it quietly, because what allowed them to keep going long enough to make that kind of mark was secondary market sales. Yeah. So,
and I think they help carry you through down periods. So, if you have secondary work that you yourself have collected, or you know where it's at, and you have collectors that you've been dealing with for years that have that work, and they come to you first before they go to an auction house, if you have those good relationships, you can tell them, oh, just hold on to it for a little bit longer, you know, and then maybe ride out the down period. And then once it comes back around again, then, you know, you can help them place those works. So I think that's just having good relationships with the collectors. But, you know, once again, when somebody calls you or emails you and puts a number in front of your face and you're like,
20%.
Sure. I'll take that and a check. And you're going to come pick it up from my house. And I don't have to do anything. I don't have to, like, I don't even have to be here. I'll just leave a key under the doormat and you guys come in and get everything and leave.
Right.
Yeah. That kind of, that level of convenience is going to trump the whole, oh, but I like this dealer so much as a person.
Yeah, because you know, dealers will, dealers want to make money. So then it becomes like the margin game of like, well, I've got somebody for the painting, but, you know, they want to pay 10% less. And it's like, no, they don't. But, you know, because you want your margin to get bigger. So it's like this whole like cat and mouse back and forth with everything. Not when an auction house walks in and there's like, here's a check. We'll take it. Don't have to do anything else. And if it sells for more than what the check is we gave you, we'll give you another 20%, you know, like, come on.
So you have a pretty good grasp of the market, it sounds like. I think people listening would sound like. So how do you see yourself playing that knowledge or turning that knowledge into the next step, I guess?
I don't know. I mean, right now I'm, I curated a show locally. You know, and it was more just about curating and staying active and going to do studio visits. And I'm looking for work, you know.
Right.
It's just, if anything, if I was going to open my own space, I would own where I was at and it would be very small and I would have a super small program, you know. Maybe you could hang 3 or 4 paintings in my garage.
Yeah.
It'd be a nice garage, don't get me wrong. But something small, and it's something that I'd probably do 3 or 4 times a year and then find a job, you know, working at a gallery, but not, you know, still having the flexibility to do some stuff outside that's my own. And also using that space to, I know that there's a lot of European galleries and, you know, young European galleries, young New York galleries that want to be in LA, but maybe don't want to pay a ton of money to be here. Their rents are high there. I'll rent out my space to you for 2 months. You can do all the shows you want for 2 months. Just pay me up front.
Yeah.
And you have this cheap space in LA. You want to be in LA.
Yeah.
Come to LA. Here's my space. Look how beautiful it is. It's a garage. Do some interesting stuff. And then you can, so it's more of them just popping up without being committed to the city.
Yeah.
They can come in, they can show artists that they like, they can come, you know, go around town, see artists that are here that maybe they want to bring to New York.
Have you introduced that offer yet to people?
No, because I don't have the space to do it in yet.
But
I
will.
Mean, it's been, I will if when that happens. Right. But it's something that I've talked to dealers in New York about where they were like, oh, it'd be really great to do something, but I need a space to do it in where maybe it's just a space. I don't have a name attached to it that maybe, you know, that you can run into that problem too, where you have, you know, a gallery that offers another gallery to show there, but maybe the program's not
the best caliber.
You don't want to get branded as being shown in that space. So if you have a space that's just kind of an open space where, oh, I do 4 shows a year, it's, you know, it's just, it's a relaxed atmosphere. It's no big deal. There's no pressure to sell anything because I have a regular day job. You know, then those people are going to come to your space because they're not going to be branded as anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be cool.
It's going to be all kinds of cool.
Yeah. That's great. Looking forward. So
it's so stupid. It's funny because it's like the less transparent people are, especially galleries, like their websites are kooky.
Oh, yeah.
The less knowledge you can get, like, what are their hours? When are they open? It doesn't say. I can't find anything online. All of a sudden, it becomes like this drive to like find out. And then you're like, but I keep on seeing all this press about them. I don't know what hours they keep, and I can't figure it out. They become cool.
Opacity
and I'm like,
is...
so it's the less you care, it seems like, the cooler it is.
Yeah. Totally not cool to care.
So that's what I'm saying. I'm going to garage. I'm going to make garage nice and really not care about it.
Right.
But do cool stuff.
Right. Got it. Okay. Now
my driveway is always open.
Sounds awesome.
So if you're considering a job, then would you be willing to work at like a, you know, behemoth like House and Worth type of situation?
No.
Yeah. So you're looking for a family situation. Then,
not
right?
a family, but something that's probably younger.
Mid-tier.
I would say a younger gallery.
Yeah.
If anything.
Well, how do you get paid if you're working on a younger gallery?
They get money. There's people around that have spaces yeah. that are younger. I mean, I'm not
a well-financed younger gallery.
Yeah, there's young. Yeah, there's well-financed. But the other thing too is I'm not. I mean, look, I haven't worked since March.
Yeah.
I'm not dying.
Right.
You know, so I'm okay to take. I shouldn't even say that aloud.
No, you shouldn't say it aloud.
But
you have flexibility to
have
make
flexibility
choices based
make
on
choices.
Passion.
Yes. There you go. That's where I was going to go with that.
Nice.
Which is something I actually talked to yeah. recently in yeah. an interview. We had a discussion about it. I'm like, well, you know, I'm not in a hurry. You're not in a hurry. So let's just date for a little bit. Maybe it'll work out. Maybe it won't. There's not a lot of pressure on me. And they're not in a hurry to pick. They're not in a hurry to.
Yeah.
To take somebody on, because right now they've sold out a couple shows. They're not in a hurry to take anybody on.
Yeah.
So, but they know my background. I know some of the artists in the program already. So yeah. it's, you know.
So that's on the table.
It's on the table, but who knows yeah. what'll happen.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
That doesn't generally get asked in interviews with men.
In conversations either.
Or in conversations, thank you. But I'm talking about like print and other
sure.
formats. About dealing with the art world and also fatherhood. Because I feel like it's something, parenthood is something that's asked of women all the time. When you're dealing with having a built relationship to a particular workspace and then suddenly you also have these other responsibilities. How's fatherhood going? And is that something that you think about in relation to where you're going to go next?
Yeah. And I've been clear about it in the last two interviews that,
yeah.
you know, it's probably one of the first things I bring up. I was like, oh, you know, I have a 2-year-old. So yeah. that they're aware that I have a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
So 2-year-olds get sick. I may not be here
yeah.
on a Wednesday, you know? Because I have flexibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, my wife's job, maybe there's less flexibility.
Yeah.
So there's certain roles and things that I take on. There's certain things and roles that she takes on. So it's kind of, you know, sharing the responsibility. But I need some flexibility. And
yeah.
I think most galleries, it's pretty flexible, especially like, you know, there's not a ton of foot traffic. You don't have to be in there all day.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of almost like a part-time job. I could work from home, really.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of what you need to do for
stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm clear about it up front. I know that it's difficult for sure. I could see where, you know, if I was working, you know, if I did work at a behemoth, you know, it probably would be...
Yeah.
A problem.
Yeah.
Because you have to feed that giant beast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to be like,
here's the quota. And
here's your quarter sales need to be, you know, $2 million in a quarter. And you're like, oh God, how am I going to do this? So is that $2 million net to you? Or what are we talking? Gross?
Yeah.
So then that two is really four. So you have to like find ways to sell it. And it's like, that could be, you could be up all night. Trying to do stuff, and that's a lot of stress. And then you got a 2-year-old running around.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, nightmare.
Yeah.
Especially like forget your weekends, forget your time with that kid.
It's really nice. It's really nice to hear you talking about that, because I'm of two minds of the parenting thing in relation to the art world and careers in general. But you know, there are so many. I work with a number of artists who are parents of relatively young or very young children. And there's a lot of, I think, conversation about what that means to your career as a woman artist and the rest of it. But the men artists that I work with who have kids are equally as involved, very fully parenting partners, very fully doing like kid pickups and all the rest of it. And so I like kind of bringing that up as well, because it's just nice to hear about the way it factors and how you work around it.
Yeah. It's, you know, it works because it's, I mean, it, you know, when I was at Mark's, it works in the way that I take her to daycare in the morning. She picks her up after work.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's days where I do both. There's days that she does both. But it's, I guess the better way to put it is if you have a partner that is you're equal and you're both comfortable with how you talk to each other and you are, then yeah. it totally works. If it, because yeah. you can manage anything.
Yeah.
So I'm not, my family's first, I guess, for stuff. You know, and I do want to spend time with my kids. So, you know, if there was, well, you have to be here on Sunday for some collectors to be here. Right. I mean, if I knew in advance and I didn't know 2 hours before, then you know, I can make that work. But most of the time, collectors don't show up when they're going to say they're going to show up.
That's a true story.
That's a true detail.
Do you want to hear every time? I've got them all written down in a journal.
I'm going to start keeping that okay, journal, so
in
too.
In the order of reliability for a studio visit, we've got at the top, artists. In the middle, gallerists.
Yeah.
Below that, museum representatives. And at the very bottom of reliability of a studio visit, collectors.
I won't even... There were times that... Somebody, okay, can I come by on Monday? Sure, you can come by on Monday. Here's what I want you to do. You're going to call me Monday morning, 1 hour before we're supposed to meet, to let me know you're going to be there, because I knew it'd take me an hour to get to the gallery.
Right.
You call me 1 hour before. So I'd just get up and do my shit during the day, and then whatever happened, they call or they don't call.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is your wife's work?
Project manager. So she works
construction. What are we talking about?
No, tech. So webs,
web stuff.
Yeah,
got it. Okay, yeah. Okay. Do you, Deb? So here's the. I'm being mindful of. I mean, I said this when I talked to Michelle Gravner, who has every checkbox checked, you know, in terms of what an artist does, including being a mother. And I kind of asked her very much tongue in cheek. So what is it like to have it all, you know, right?
And somebody
actually sort of, I don't know how serious they were, but they said, why did you ask her that question? I was in quotes, you know?
Right.
So what do we need to ask now that we have a father that we would be remiss if we didn't ask?
I think mostly you already answered it, which was about balance and where you place the priorities. But it is, I mean,
keep in mind, it's only one.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was dealing with three, I have...
No, it's...
I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I hit two and I was very clear that three was not a thing that was going to happen.
One's totally manageable right now.
Yeah.
Two is probably going to be manageable.
Yeah. Two, they start to kind of like hang out with each other and distract each other a little bit. Yeah. First couple years is really rough.
That's the dream.
They'll just raise each other. They're fine. They're fine.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's, I love that you asked that. I think that the reason so many women have a little bit of a button of the what's it like to have it all question is just because it's been something that's gone back and forth in terms of the way that you approach, in quotations, women who work, right, forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my own psyche, you certainly have to battle that no matter how aware you are, because I can tell you offhand probably 10 women who are gallerists or curators in the art world who I know have children, and we've talked about that balance and how hard it is and all the rest of it. And I could not name nearly as many men, even though, of course, there are a zillion of them out there. So it's that thing of still assuming that if you're a father and you are working in a high-pressure job, that's not a conflict. But if you are a mother and you're working in a high-pressure job, that's a conflict. And you're either going to be judged as too absent in one area or another area.
Right.
And there's going to be somebody out there who says, oh gosh, she's gone all the time doing those art fairs. Or there's going to be somebody who says, oh gosh, she should do about three more art fairs. And why isn't she staying those extra 2 days each time to have dinner with collectors and see curators at local museums? So it is a constant dialogue, still, I think, that is spoken more for women. But then again, as I said, the fathers I know who are operating this world, in this world, who are very, very involved, are dealing with the same tensions, the same, I want to be with my kids and pick them up from school, whether they're 2 or 9 or 11, as long as I still have that time where they want to be with me. And that means that I can't apply to as many residencies constantly and keep up with my full-time job and my practice. It means that I can't...
Wait, what?
Go to... and it means that... Just delete it.
I will.
Just cross it out. Keep up with my full-time job. Okay. So, you know, it's a... So I think it's great to talk about.
But I think as the kids, you know, we're talking about galleries. I mean, it's like what, you know, anybody, I guess, in general, like specifically galleries. I mean, as your kid gets older and if you are traveling all the time, then it becomes easier to take them with you. And then they get to go to places,
you know. Absolutely.
Of course, it gets more expensive with children to go, but it's not like you're paying 2 employees to come with you. Yeah, so.
Totally.
Yeah. But as they get older, that's nice because they get to travel. At least they go with you, and you know, as they're older, they can kind of take care of themselves. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying like don't leave a 6-year-old because it seems like they can take care of themselves inside the hotel room by themselves. Not like that ever happened to me, but you know,
yeah,
they get to go with you. So,
well, I think the important thing that you referred to when you were talking about being asked. Or just sharing that you have a kid at the interviews is that they basically, for the most part, seem fine with that. I guess to go back to all the things that you were saying, what do we think the person on the other side of the table would say if it was a woman saying the same thing? Would it be an equal response?
I think there would be more anxiety.
If it was a male gallerist, yeah, totally. I know some artists have had studio visits with some people, and once they find out that woman has a kid, they're usually like,
"Yeah,
yeah, wow."
And it's hard to,
which I could understand, even if it was an employee.
Yeah,
then it's going to be.
There's that same, but there is, generally speaking. I mean, not to go into a whole thing, but generally speaking, culturally, we have more confidence in men's ability to do what they say they're going to do. And we tend to question women's ability to do the same thing more. And we tend to assume when it comes to childcare that women are going to feel more pulled by that than men do. So it's a conflict of interest.
Where are those voices coming from, just to clarify?
Oh gosh, you want
is
me to,
that the societal
you want
voice?
Me to go there?
I totally want you to go there. I don't know who says that.
Talk about the onset of Cartesian thought and enlightenment reason. But I do,
you know what though? It could be, and also it could be geographical.
Yeah.
Let's just say that if I was in Iowa, I was, then people would be like, "What are you crazy? Why are you doing that?" You know, like, not that Iowans talk like that. Sorry, but I think geographically, being in Los Angeles.
Definitely.
There's an understanding.
Definitely.
You know, like everybody's here. We're all together. We get it. You know, like you're going to know that that's, you know, men and women both have partners, anybody.
Yeah.
Men, women.
Right.
They have kids.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. And everybody's able to still do their jobs.
Yeah.
Because that's why we're here. I think, it's a geographical thing where I think that, you know, it's not frowned upon maybe here is maybe some other cities that might be
definitely
more, not that it's not, but
definitely. Though I will say that, you know, I have a former classmate who is now a very sort of successful surgeon, and she has 3 children, and every interview that I've seen or read with her, it comes up as if it is something that's on her CV. So how amazing, you know, with men who are interviewing, how amazing that you have all these accomplishments and, oh my gosh, 3 kids. And there's always this like super excited kind of like big smile, like I'm going to give you a cookie for figuring it all out, you know, and you know that with these particular people that would never come with a, you have a heart surgeon up there who's a man and you're going to say, gosh, and how do you do this with those three kids at home? You know, like it just, it's a, yeah, it's a thing.
And where's your friend?
She's in LA. Yeah.
So you disprove some of that geography.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's still, right. it's a deep part of the cultural narrative, just like right. so many other things are that we're all trying to figure out how to deal with and unlearn. But I also very much agree that it's much, much less so in most major metropolitan areas than it would be in any place else. And especially that the idea of understanding and not automatically assuming that the gender roles would be predefined in terms of parenting is, you know, much more so here yeah. than it would be otherwise.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is related, but I can give you a snippet of the birth
story. I love snippets. Yeah.
Of the birth story.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm
we
ready.
We were making a joke about it last night because it was my kid's birthday. Was that we're at the hospital and, you know, things are going along, but not as fast as maybe the doctor wants them to go.
Right.
So my wife is exhausted. She just wants to like close her eyes for like 15 minutes. So yeah. I go out to the nurse's station. Hey, can you just turn down the lights? We're just going to like let her calm down. Things yeah. are a little rough right now. Just let her calm down. So we're in there. Doctor comes in with two residents, all males.
Yeah.
Rips open the curtain, throws all the lights on as soon as he comes in. So here's what we're going to do.
Oh.
Not what. Like, we're yeah. collectively going to do. He meant what they were going to do. So yeah. it was, he was talking about himself and yeah. the two residents because he really wanted to show these residents yeah. how to get a baby out.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And they talked to us and we said, you know what? We're just going to wait. We're going to wait it out. What time is your shift done? Because we want to know. So we rode them out for 6 hours. New shift started. Female lead.
Yeah.
Two residents came in very quiet, very calm,
yeah.
very peaceful, asked us what we were hoping for, what they could provide. I'm like, this is crazy. Because it was like this male's perspective of walking in a room. So you're right. pregnant. Let's just push it out now.
Right.
And then and it was like so aggressive. And I'm like, I feel terrible right now. And I'm like, she's already mad at me. And now you're making this worse.
Like, I don't want to be on your team.
Yeah,
like,
I'm not on your team, man. I don't know. And then the female, woman doctor came in, totally different scenario. And not within 2 hours later, that baby was out.
Yeah.
And I think it was just a matter of like not having.
Yeah.
It was.
We're going to crack this nut right open. Like, yeah, that energy does not actually.
But I felt like it was a male thing.
Yeah.
You know, and he was trying to like. You know, I'm a doctor, I'm a man, and I'm going to tell you what you need to do. And my wife, she's a project manager. She manages everything.
Yeah. Mm.
She read every book about everything
yeah.
for that birth. She's like, no, I'm going to wait.
Yeah.
We're fine.
She's like, actually, nah.
No.
No.
You're not.
Not so much.
This baby's not coming out with you.
Yeah.
It's coming out peacefully. In a very like, quiet, serene
I'm gonna
room.
Moderate my child's so, first experience anyways. Of the world and... It's going to be other than that.
That's. I think that's really some that's very good. Practical information to share with people.
Yeah.
People need to know what the options are, you know?
But it was funny because I was thinking last night when it was her birthday about going into my kid's room at midnight, throwing on all the lights and be like, all right, it's birthday, wake up! But my wife and I just laughed and just sat in bed laughing because I was like, can I go do it? And she's like, no, she's sleeping. Don't do it. And I was like, come on.
Bring it full circle.
That's awesome.
That's really great.
Well, I don't think we've ever wrapped things up with a pregnancy story.
That's pretty awesome.
Story.
Yeah, that was perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
Thanks, man.
I loved
You're
it.
Welcome.
Yeah, such a pleasure.
Deb, thank you.
Loved it.
And?
We're out.
Thanks again to Matthew, and thank you to Deb for co-piloting once again. I think the takeaway from that pregnancy anecdote is fire your doctor, if at all possible. I certainly have, at least to the extent that I've change to another doctor. So definitely do that if you have the opportunity. All right, before I get to the anecdote, the day job anecdote I mentioned at the top, wanted to tell you a couple of other things. One of them, I'm just going to make quick reference to the deleted word that you might have recognized at some point in the conversation, very briefly. But before that, wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. It's not an advertising-supported show at the moment. So that means that to keep the show going, we really depend on your financial support, among other things. And it would be very much appreciated if you could support the show financially. You can do that a couple of ways to keep the show going. You can become a regular supporter for as little as a dollar a month via Patreon, patreon.com. It's linked through theconversationpod.com. You can also support the show one time donation-wise with PayPal, also linked through the site. So Patreon or PayPal, very much appreciated. And if you do $3 a month or more via Patreon or $25 one time via PayPal or more, I will hook you up with some bonus episodes and some love and affection as well. So thank you in advance for that. Of course, you can also support the show by following on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And you can leave a nice review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever, and that will bring more people to the show with your great review. You could also recommend me, the host, to other podcasts. Going on another platform will be a way to spread the word to a new audience as well. So thank you in advance for all those things very much. So yeah, the word that was deleted, it's the P word. If you are new to the show, it's the, as in my art, P-R-A-C-T-I-C-E. It's, that word is now banned from the show. So if somebody accidentally says it, I have to cut it out now. So I encourage you not to say it in your daily life, in your daily art, and so on. I'm not kidding about this. This word needs to be removed in that context. If you're going to soccer practice or dance practice, that's fine. But not my art P word, okay? Please. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Let's just get rid of it, okay? Roberta Smith of the New York Times wrote an article about it. I can link it on the website or to you directly if you have not read it. All right. On to the anecdote. So this is the day job anecdote. And before I launch into that, I just wanted to remind you, if you are have already heard, or introduce to you if you have not heard yet, that I have been slowly but surely working on the beginnings of another podcast altogether. It's not an art podcast at all. It is a podcast about how people get by financially across every imaginable spectrum or every imaginable type of getting by situation. And at least that's the hope. It could be people who are creative types who do three or four different gigs. It could be somebody who has a full-time job and they just do a lot of interesting stuff to get by along with or in addition to that. It could be to somebody doing a job that you never even imagine existed. It could be any of those things. And so it's, I'm going to have conversations with these people about how they get by and by way of that, get into their stories, their personal stories. So that's the gist of that situation. If you are curious, intrigued, and interested and want to help out on that show, get in touch and I will maybe send you a couple sample episodes. I've already recorded about 7 and edited about half of them in advance of whenever the show comes out, which I'd like to have a backlog of shows so that it can come out consistently. And these people aren't easy to find. So if you want to provide feedback to me, I will send you a couple. Just shoot me an email. All right. Finally. So I, like a lot of you, I assume, do various things to make a living. This show does not provide my full income, believe it or not. The income from the show is very, very minimal. Anyway, I do a few different things, and I have one of the things I've done from time to time is assisted people. I'm sure some of you out there assist artists or something similar. I have assisted different kinds of people, artists a long time ago, but more recently, not artists, different types of people. And my most recent endeavor assisting somebody, here comes the anecdote, has been with a guy who called the job executive assistant. Now, just to get, set this up, he is not an executive of any kind. He doesn't appear to work. He has roommates in the house that he appears to own, probably through his parents, but he does not work as far as I can tell. Anyway, so he has had me doing a number of bizarre things. And to make this story as concise as possible and not convoluted, it could take a whole episode getting into all the details, which are pretty fascinating if you're into that kind of thing. I'm just going to boil it down to the gist, which is that he lives in a neighborhood near a university where, according to him, some students will park in front of people's houses in his neighborhood and just loiter, hang out, carouse, get drunk, what have you. And in order to avoid that, he took it upon himself to park a secondary car in the space in front of his house next to his driveway. And that car has been a Hyundai 2001, I think, something like that. And when I initially came on board to help him, he wanted to get a second car. I'm not quite clear why, other than maybe as a backup. So he could, I think it was to rotate out the car. So he would have one car, the Hyundai, in front of the house for a week, and then he'd have this secondary car of about the same value, replace it for a week, and so on. So initially, I was going to buy a car for him. We were on the verge of getting a 2001 Infiniti, and then it fell through at the last minute. And then he ended up deciding that it turned out he had a car that had been towed a couple months ago, or a little less than a couple months ago, and he was going to get that out of hock from the tow place. And as we were about to do that, he decided, no, he was going to wait until it went to auction. And then instead of, at the last minute, he decided, no, I'm not going to risk having somebody else buy it out of my hands. So I'm going to pay the fee to get it out of hock, including all the penalties for the days it's been in there. So we did that at the last second. We had that car. And then we had the two cars, right? So cut to a couple of weeks ago. The Hyundai, which had been, meanwhile, remained in front of the house all this time, got towed. Why did it get towed? Because while the registration was paid for through the end of the year, the sticker was from 2016, and the reason for that was because the car needed a smog check, which he had told me about but had neglected to take care of. So that basically meant that I had to go through the process of going through the steps, going to the Department of Motor Vehicles and so on to get it out of hock. And we did, or I did, and then we together went to the tow place, brought it back to his place. And meanwhile, the secondary car, which we had bought at the last minute before it was going to go up for auction, which had been parked down the street, I parked that where the Hyundai had been parked in front of the house. And he said, park the Hyundai. So this was the Acura now that's in front of the house. He said, park the Hyundai up the street, which I did. And that was a couple weeks ago. It still does not have the sticker. And for all I know, it has been towed as well. And guess what? I am not going to enter into that situation again, because as you can imagine, working for somebody who is not only entitled but clueless, or should I say not only clueless but entitled, is not fun for a number of reasons. It doesn't provide any sustenance other than the pay, which was not insignificant but certainly not amazing. So all that said, I'm not too worried that he's going to be hounding me to get me back over there. But if he does, I'm going to have to pass. I could get into more details about the stories, about the moments along the way. I'll just give you one. We're at the tow place together, and it's a little complicated. You have to ring a bell, go through this side door. In the past, we had rung the bell and nobody came. It turns out that's because they were closed at that location. But you see guys milling about in the actual tow area behind this retractable iron gate. The gate had opened for some reason, and so he walked through it, and I followed him stupidly. So we're sitting there on the other side of the gate, and the guy, one of the guys sort of manning the tow lot is like, what the fuck are you doing? You're supposed to go around to the other side of the gate. So we're basically sitting there kind of trapped in humiliation, waiting for somebody to open the gate again so we can go back to the appropriate entrance. So that's just one little lovely snapshot of that experience. All right, that's enough day job anecdote for now. If you are interested in sampling some of the episodes of the show, it's not going to be anything like that, by the way, get in touch. And thank you very much for listening to this here podcast. Thank you for your support. I am open to your feedback, conversation, what have you. So let us know what you think. Thanks very much, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.